This is Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm Steve Taylor, your host to a horror anthology podcast with carefully curated original tales of terror each week. Our deepest rooted fears are brought to the forefront by a diverse cast of voice talent and masterfully eerie sound design. Make sure to check out Chilling Tales for Dark Nights wherever you get your podcasts. To subscribe now to always be the first to enjoy the horror show.
Hi, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Stacy.
And we make Trashy Divorces, everybody's favorite good podcast about bad relationships.
Looking for something true crimey without the gore or the body count?
We've been churning out funny, feisty, feminist episodes since 2019. So if you're looking to put some scandalous stories told well into your ears this summer, check out Trashy Divorces, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Trust us, we've covered someone you love.
Or someone you love to hate.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Irene Garza? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Irene Garza was born in 1934 and raised in McAllen, Texas. This is a town in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, on the border with Mexico. Irene's parents, Nicholas and Josefina, owned a dry cleaning business and were quite successful. By the time Irene was a teenager, her parents had moved from the south side of McAllen, which was economically disadvantaged, to the north side, which was considered upscale. Irene graduated from high school and from college. She was the homecoming queen in college, and in 1958 was crowned Miss All South Texas Sweetheart. I'm not sure the word all is required in that title. Was there a sum of South Texas Sweetheart? Either way, despite Irene's success with endeavors that appear to have a social component, she mostly kept to herself. She was described as extremely shy. Irene continued to live with her parents even after graduating from college. She found work as a second grade teacher at a school in the south side of town. She considered it her life's work to help underprivileged children. Irene was Roman Catholic and was quite serious about it. She told people that attending Mass daily was important to her. Irene tried to follow all the rules of the church, including going to confession. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On April 16, 1960, the day before Easter, 25-year-old Irene Garza drove 12 blocks to Sacred Heart Church. Her intent was to go to confession before Easter. She was not alone. There were a lot of people there. She was spotted by several witnesses at the church that evening, but nobody saw her after 8 p.m. Irene did not return home when expected, but her parents initially didn't worry. They thought that maybe she had decided to stay at the church and attend midnight mass. At about 3 a.m., her parents realized that something was wrong. They reported their daughter missing to the McAllen Police Department. Here's what the police found during their investigation. On April 18, 2 days after Irene went missing, her shoe was found in a field. The next day, her purse was found in a field along the same road. The police and volunteers engaged in a massive search. On April 21, at 7:40 a.m., Irene's body was found in a canal several miles from where her property had been recovered. Medical examiners determined that she had been the victim of an assault of a sexual nature, beaten, and suffocated. A Kodak slide viewer was found in the canal several days later when the police drained it. In one documentary on this case, an officer incorrectly described this device as one that projected an image of a slide onto a surface. In reality, that's not how it worked. This machine was a Kodaslide Dial Light Viewer Model A. It was designed for a viewer to look at a slide through a lens. It was an unusual item to be found at the scene of a body disposal. One might expect a gun or a knife to be found near a murder victim, but not a slide viewer. The police asked people in the community who this machine belonged to. A 27-year-old priest named Father John Bernard Feit came forward and said it was his. As it turns out, he was the priest who heard Irene's last confession. John had been born in 1932 in Chicago, Illinois. He was ordained in 1958, so he was a new priest. The police asked John about what happened on the night Irene disappeared. Here's what he told them. He and another priest named Father Joseph O'Brien were getting ready to leave the rectory to hear more confessions at the church when the phone rang. It was Irene Garza. She told John that she was fearful about making confession because she thought other people would overhear her. John allowed her to come to the rectory where he heard Irene's confession just after 7 p.m. When they were done, he walked Irene to the door and she made her way to the church. The police noticed that John had scratches on the back of his hands. To explain the scratches, John offered the police a complex story. He said that he often played with his eyeglasses nervously during confessions. On the night Irene disappeared, he had lost a screw from his glasses by doing this. So he was like twisting them around and the screw fell out. He drove to the church's pastoral house, which was about 5 miles away, in order to get another pair of glasses. Upon arriving, he realized he didn't have a key for that house. Therefore, instead of driving back, he climbed over the wall surrounding the house. He fell off the wall and scratched the back of his hands. The police believe that John could have been responsible, but as it turns out, they conspired with Catholic Church officials to cover up John's involvement. I'll talk more about that later. Despite having this protection, John did get in trouble for other behavior. A woman accused him of assaulting her when she was at another church in the McAllen area. The case went to trial, but the jury could not reach a verdict. John pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor charge of aggravated assault, rather than taking his chances with a second trial. He was fined $500. John would later claim that he did not realize that a no contest plea meant that he was convicted of that crime. John continued his career as a priest, but he was transferred to a Trappist monastery in Missouri called Assumption Abbey. In 1963, while receiving counseling at that monastery, he allegedly told a monk named Dale Tacheney that he murdered a young lady in Texas. Nothing was done with this information at that time. John was transferred to a facility in New Mexico which treated priests with behavioral problems. He ended up becoming a staff member by joining the order that ran that facility. Eventually, he was promoted to a supervisory position.
In January of 2008, real estate agent Lindsay Buziak received a call from a woman who said that she and her husband were urgently seeking a home with a budget of $1 million. Eager for the commission a deal like this would bring, Lindsay found the perfect home and set up a showing. Just 1 hour after the showing, Buziak's colleagues found her lying in a pool of blood in the master bedroom with multiple stab wounds. To this day, the case remains unsolved. I'm Savannah Breimer, host of the true crime podcast Killer Instinct, the research-backed show that covers cases like Lindsay's and aims to bring justice to the families of victims of horrific crimes. Each month, I explore a new sector of true crime, from serial killers to stalkers to female killers. For each case, I break down the moments leading up to the crime, debunk past theories, and share the experiences of those affected by these tragedies. Join me every Wednesday as I unveil the truth behind some of the darkest cases in history. Listen and subscribe to Killer Instinct wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1972, John decided it was time to give up on being a priest. He ended up getting married and moving to Phoenix, Arizona. He later had 3 children. John worked as a volunteer at a Catholic food charity. In 2002, 42 years after the murder, the monk who John allegedly confessed to in Missouri, Dale Tacheney, decided to contact the authorities in Texas about what John had told him. Eventually, Texas Rangers became involved and reopened the murder investigation. They contacted Father Joseph O'Brien. Again, he was the priest who was with John on the night Irene disappeared. Joseph told them that John had confessed to him not long after the murder. In 2004, the district attorney of Hidalgo County brought the case before a grand jury, but they did not indict John Fite. In 2014, a new district attorney was elected. He had an interest in Irene's case and reopened the investigation. In February of 2016, 83-year-old John Fite was arrested for Irene's murder. He pleaded not guilty and went to trial. John was convicted on December 7, 2017. He was sentenced to life in prison, which for him turned out to be a short sentence. John Fite died on February 12, 2020. Now moving to my analysis. Even up until his death, John Fite denied involvement in the murder of Irene Garza. Some people believe that he was innocent, noting that the case against him had been repeatedly demonstrated as shaky. Others thought that the right person had been convicted. Let's take a look at the evidence both for and against the idea that John Fite was guilty, starting with the inculpatory factors. John admitted to hearing Irene's confession in the rectory, which was highly unusual. He initially lied to the police about this. A witness testified that Irene told her that John had once pulled her out of a church confessional, insisting that she give her confession in the rectory. Witnesses did not see Irene after her encounter with John Fite. They said that on the night Irene disappeared, John's confession line was moving slowly. For some reason, I imagine parishioners in line tapping their feet, saying, "These sins are not going to absolve themselves. Let's keep it moving." John's slide viewer was found in the same canal where Irene's body was discovered. He had scratches on his hands and offered a complex explanation involving scaling a wall. He told the police that he randomly drove around after leaving the pastoral house. Irene's shoe and purse were found in the same area where he said he was driving. The priest who was with John on the night of Irene's disappearance, Joseph O'Brien, said that John confessed to killing Irene. The jury never heard about this because Joseph died in 2005, 12 years before the trial. The monk in Missouri, Dale Tacheny, said that in 1963, John confessed to killing a young lady in Texas. John attacked a young woman about 3 weeks before Irene was killed and pleaded no contest to that offense. Moving to the exculpatory factors, John was pretty busy on the night of the murder. He celebrated midnight mass and was seen by many people. Joseph O'Brien had dementia when he told the police that John confessed to him. He had previously denied knowing anything about the case. Dale Tacheny waited for years to come forward with his story. Initially, he falsely believed the crime had occurred in San Antonio, Texas. Later, the police told Dale details about the crime. John never specifically told Dale that he killed Irene. Rather, he killed a young lady in Texas. That could have been any number of people. Supposedly, John's motive for the murder was that Irene triggered him into a rage because her high heels were clicking on a hard floor. If John was guilty, his motive was almost certainly not related to high heel clicking sounds. After John left McAllen, Texas, it does not appear as though he ever killed anybody or found himself in any trouble. When considering all the evidence in this case, do I think that John Fite was guilty? Yes, I believe he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Even disregarding Dale's testimony, there was enough evidence against John. He placed himself with the victim right before she disappeared and along the route where her belongings were found. Moving to the next question, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. From an early age, John had desires that were disturbing to him. He became a priest hoping to avoid temptation and to live a pious lifestyle. This proved more difficult than he originally believed, as his impulsivity, arrogance, sadism, and sense of entitlement grew out of control. 3 weeks after attacking a woman, he killed Irene Garza. He had been contemplating this murder for a while and was just waiting for his opportunity. John managed to get rid of Irene's body, but left behind his slide viewer. From the very beginning, the police and Catholic Church officials knew that John Fite was guilty. There were a lot of Catholics in McAllen, Texas, including the sheriff. Nobody wanted to accuse a priest of murder. A Catholic bishop wrote a letter to the police talking about the wider implications of trying to convict John Fite. The bishop mentioned how it could affect John F. Kennedy, a Catholic who had announced his intent to run for president just 4 months before Irene was murdered. Anti-Catholic sentiment was already elevated in the United States, and the bishop was afraid that John F. Kennedy may not be elected if a Catholic priest was charged with murder. The bishop planned on moving John Fite to a monastery in order to prevent further murders. The refusal to prosecute John Fite is perhaps the only conspiracy theory involving John F. Kennedy which is actually true. The Catholic Church and the police conspired to arrest anti-Catholic sentiment by not arresting John Fite. Now moving to my final thoughts. Irene Garza made a commitment to the Catholic belief system and wanted to live a pure life. She went to see John Fite right before Easter in order to receive absolution for her sins. She thought her sins would be exposed in the presence of a priest, but as it turns out, only the sins of the priest would be exposed. John's status as a priest protected him from prosecution for 57 years and made it so that, functionally, he didn't really pay any price at all. He lived his life as if he was a changed man, but ultimately failed to make a terminal confession.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.